Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a great civilization possible? Strong leadership counts, a large, diverse, and creatively motivated population is important. And as my guest today has learned in his study of numerous ancient civilizations, great societies tend to coalesce around regions where the water supply is stable and plentiful and can fall into chaos with shocking speed when climate change shifts conditions in which food is produced. But they can also respond to such changes in strikingly positive ways. Fekri Hassan is Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at University College London. He's in town to give the Fred Wendorf Distinguished Lecture in Archaeology at SMU Saturday evening at 5:30. The talk is titled Living on the Edge, Origins and Spread of Food Production in the Near East and North Africa. Fekri, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So how did the annual flooding of the Nile River allow for the development of this rich and really remarkable civilization in ancient Egypt?
Well, you know, Egypt would not have existed without the Nile. It's the source of life in a desert. Egypt is mostly desert and traversed by the Nile, which is fed by water from Ethiopia and equatorial Africa. So every year when the Nile floods the area, it deposits mud, which is useful for growing crops. And at the same time, it irrigates the land every year during the summer. And so that's essentially a major water supply and a source of land. And so without that water, Egyptian civilization would have never started. It would have remained, a very small country with very small resources. I mean, look at Libya next to it. That would be a very similar situation. But the greatness of Egypt was the ability of people then to make use of this annual flood and create an agricultural cycle and produce food. But then in the process, they were also suffering from fluctuations in Nile floods.
And throughout history, it's never exactly the same any 2 years, right? The flooding of the Nile?
No, I mean, that's what's exciting because when people think that the Egyptians just have to wait for the Nile floods and then, as Herodotus said, you know, you throw a few seeds and then you wait and then it comes up and it's all wonderful. I mean, it's absolutely untrue. I mean, in many cases, as in the medieval period, one of every five floods was a catastrophic flood. Mm. And it led to severe famines, even in historical times. And we know there was also a severe famine 4,200 years ago when successive periods of low Nile floods forced people to eat famine foods.
All right, let's talk about that time. There was a dramatic departure from stability in the region. There had been a very long reign by a king named Pepi II. Mm-hmm. What sort of upheaval took place in the monarchy when things went crazy?
This is really an incredible chapter in Egyptian history that has often been overlooked because when people look at Egypt, they just look at the pyramids and the treasures of Tutankhamun, etc., which is wonderful to grasp. But at the same time, if we want to learn something about civilization, because ours is also probably facing some very serious problems, we have to not to glamorize the past, but to look at it in a very realistic ways. As people like us who have been living with climate change, who are living with political problems, who are living with religious problems, all this has happened before. It's nothing really new. And we need to find out the principles, you know, by which things are made and the principle to which they break and the principle to which they are put back together. And I think a lot of work now need to go into this process of recovery because I think we are already in trouble in our modern civilization and we need to look at recovery processes. So in ancient Egypt, what happened was this succession of very low Nile floods and it happened very, very fast. We used to think in the past that climate change, you know, takes thousands of years to happen. But now we know that within 20 years, you can, or sometimes less than a decade, you can have a major dramatic change in the amount of rain, in temperature, in seasons. And of course, that affects people's livelihood. So when this happened, a lot of people in the villages starved, essentially, and a lot of death has been recorded and depopulation. As a result of that, people could not pay taxes. And the monarchy depended on taxes. So with no taxes, the king could not pay for his government. He could not pay for any relief functions to save the rest of the country. And at the same time, there was also a tax on Egypt from the east frontiers, because people in the deserts were also getting hungry, mm-hmm. and they were going down to the Nile Valley. And he could not raise an army to fight these people. So within a very short time, you know, maybe 60 years, the monarchy was dissolved, the centralized government collapsed, a lot of chaos and mayhem and violence and crimes. And after that initial phase of chaos, the process of recovery began by what I call entrepreneurs. They were not from the royal family. They were ex-governors and ex-bureaucrats who decided to take it on themselves to put back the country together. And I think the worst thing was people were demoralized. So the job of these new governors and entrepreneurs was to boost the morality of the people, bring them back together, give them a sense that, yes, we can go on, we can do it, and we can develop this country again. And they reallocated populations to certain areas. They started to build irrigation canals because the Nile was very low and areas on the sides where the water did not reach them. So through the works of these people, the country was even better than it was before. Because in addition to this social aggregation, bringing people together, and the technical project of digging canals, they came up with a totally new formula for the state. You know, before that, the king was everything. The king was God. He was divine, and he had to be obeyed because he was divine. That's all. And as a result of this catastrophe, people realized that if he was God, he would have saved the country. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that they began, these entrepreneurs, these new kings and new chiefs, said that they were sent by God to help the people, to help the poor, to help the orphans, to help the widows. And I think that was the greatest contribution by Egypt to civilization, because it became the seed of the moral codes that we see later on in Christianity and Judaism and Islam.
So the idea is, if you are going to be a monarch, with or without these more centralized sort of local governments also participating, there's a contract, right? You are paid by the people, you are honored by the people, but you also have a responsibility to protect them, yeah, not only from outside incursions, but from natural disasters.
Absolutely. I think this is the contract that before these divine kingships was ignored. And in fact, I think the message was not well learned. And many other countries continue to follow a divine despotic system where people were usually exploited. And we know that it's only recently in Europe, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, that we have to have this move to get away from this kind of divine kingship in the name of many different religions. And even in China, I mean, you had the same thing about the emperor as God, in a way, or divine. In many other countries, this was the case. And only recently, where we began to honor the contract between a president or a chief of a state and the people, and that, you know, goes back to no more than 300 or 200 years. So the ideas that were already raised in Egypt 4,000 years ago took a very long time, as it is usually the case with new ideas, to become a global phenomenon.
How invested were ancient Egyptian leaders in preserving the rights of people to have diverse religious beliefs?
Well, the state did not intervene with the public worship systems. And there were a lot of family religions, a lot of local religions, a lot of provincial religions. And so that was tolerated. But the state had its own religion, of course, and they had the temples for that. But there was no, we do not know of any persecution in Egypt on the basis of religious diversity.
Were the very large societies that lived along the Nile 4,300 years ago in some ways a victim of their own success? Did the population simply get too large to sustain itself when the Nile didn't cooperate or didn't behave as people had come to expect it to behave?
No, that was never the case in Egypt. Mm-hmm. I think the idea of unlimited population increase is only symptomatic of our own civilization. This is, you know, when you look at the rise of world populations, you'd be astounded that until 350 years ago or 300 years ago, you know, the world population was in hundreds of millions, not in billions. It's only after 1750 that we have an incredibly steep rise in world population. And so I think if that is true, it would be true of our own civilization. And I think we are aggravating our position by becoming vulnerable to climate change.
Can you tell us about how geoarchaeologists take data from the natural world and line it up with what we know of historical events and find patterns?
Well, it's an exciting field. And I was privileged to be a part of the group that started geoarchaeology in the States when I was at Washington State University. And the approach is actually interesting because it says, well, let us use geological knowledge to find out something about climate change, about changes in surface processes, and how does that relate to people. So, for example, the work we are doing in Egypt on this catastrophe at 4,200 ago, we take cores from the ground, like in oil drilling, and analyze the sediments of the Nile to see what was the floodplain like and what were the conditions like. And we also discover through this process the place of old settlements that have been buried on as a result of the floods. So we are able to show the movements of the Nile and how it affects even the capitals that existed. And we are able to show these periods of break. And we are able to tell, like, after the catastrophe, what happened is that these new kings began a national irrigation project in an area called the Fayum. This is a huge depression that is fed by a branch from the Nile. And during this catastrophic dry period, this lake dried up. And so when they saw the lake bed and realized that it could be used for farming, and then the king can have his own real estate so he doesn't have to depend just on taxes in case there is another famine, they began a hydraulic project. Now, people depended on statements by Herodotus, who visited Egypt 500 BC, and he said, well, the Egyptian excavated this depression and used it as a reservoir. Well, what we found was that the reservoir was not in the depression. The depression is too huge to be dug by anybody anyway.
Let me jump in for a second. We need to take a quick break, and I want you to be able to finish the story. My guest is Dr. Fekri Hassan, Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at University College London, in town to speak at SMU Saturday evening. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Fekri Hassan, Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at University College London. He's in town to give the Fred Wendorf Distinguished Lecture in Archaeology at SMU this Saturday evening at 5:30. The title of that talk is Living on the Edge, Origins and Spread of Food Production in the Near East and North Africa. You can be part of our conversation today by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Fekri, so Herodotus visits the region in 500 BC. He looks at this lake depression and says, oh, the king clearly must have used this as a reservoir, but that wasn't what happened.
No, that's the important aspect of geoarchaeological work when you are trying to sometimes find something that has never been mentioned in history, but at the same time look at historical stories, because we know that history is not necessarily about reality, is to check that against actual record. We usually say that sediments do not lie. I mean,
but they lie underground, but they don't
do. Yes. So we went to the Fayum and we began a drilling program and looking at sediments, and we discovered that water was reintroduced to the depression after the lake has dried up. But we discovered that the main reason for bringing the water back in the lake is not to make it in the reservoir, but actually to reclaim it as a land area. Because once it dried up, you could see that there is a lake bed and it could be irrigated if you bring water in again. But if you let the water come freely, the lake will fill up, and then you wouldn't have any land to cultivate. So what they decided, and we discovered that from the drilling, that they would create a dam at the entry. And that dam can be opened and closed through sluice gates. And once the flood comes in, they will let the water in until a certain level, which guaranteed that they would have a cultivable land. And the rest of the water can go in the deeper part of the depression. And then they would begin to cultivate that land, which belonged to the king, to the real estate. But then they would close the gates of the water going in the depression. And the rest of the water goes into a reservoir in front of the dam. And so we changed it, or we corrected the story. Yes, there was a reservoir, but it was not in the depression, which is a natural depression. It was not dug by the people, as Herodotus said. And that the new depression that they created was, in fact, on the outside of the main depression. And it connected through a canal to the royal cities and the pyramid cities that were higher on the floodplain and could not be reached in normal years. So it was an ingenious project that we discovered through geoarchaeological work, contrary, and corrected the information that was provided by Herodotus.
It seems so logical to us today when we hear that explanation, but the thought of people doing this for the first time, right? Yeah. These are not PhDs in engineering figuring this out. These are regular people working their way through this. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of education they would have had, and did they apprentice to work on similar projects, or do we know anything about how these ideas arose and how they were executed?
Well, I think that's what I refer to as ingenuity in my model about cultural change. I mean, I usually think of three aspects of development at any time. One of them is exigency, is like climate change, something that you cannot control, or a plague. And then there is contingency. See, what do you do to meet with that? You know, there are certain conditions that are contingent upon what happens. And then there is ingenuity. And I think the reasons for having the capacity to come up with new innovations is not just innate in us as human beings, which we are innovative by nature, but in many cases we become conservative by choice, because you do not want to innovate all the time. You end up with chaos. So the human systems are usually conservative, but they allow a certain degree of innovation, and they vary in how much they allow. So, you know, our PhDs, our graduate schools are to prepare these people to be able to be innovators, especially in an open society that sees its future in the youth and in innovation. And in ancient Egypt, they did have schools. They did have the people learn math, they learned geometry, because all that was related first to the measurement of the land, because in order to get taxes, they needed people to know arithmetic and geometry. So that was the beginning of geometry. But what is very interesting is also the beginning of science as we know it, because they were afraid of the Nile and its heights, whether it's going to be very low or very high. So what they've done, they created gadgets, a standard measure for observations, and that's the beginning of science, is they have a systematic observation using standard units. So that began very early on, even before civilization as we know it started, they were using that. And the first record of the monarchy in Egypt shows the record of the heights of the Nile. And so, but they also entered into a phase of experimentation, like the digging of little canals or doing things. And I think one of the most fascinating discoveries that we have made was also to find that they experimented with building a dam, the first fill dam in the world, during the time they were building the pyramids. And it seems that they might have wanted to dam the Nile, a feat that could only be done in the 19th century with our new equipment. But they seem to have thought about it. They went to one of the little rivers on the desert, subject to torrential floods, and they began to construct a dam. This dam was almost a replica of a pyramid, but it was a long pyramid rather than a pyramidal pyramid. So it's the linear pyramid that is in there, and at the same time as the pyramid. Sadly enough, while they were doing that, it was destroyed by a torrential flow. So I think they gave up on the idea. But there you can see that there were mathematicians, there were people in geometry, people in technical sciences, there were people experimenting with engineering, and I think all of that was part of a professional group of people that were favored by the king. So the king essentially had his royal society, royal scientific society, and royal engineering society, and these people were giving a lot of privileges. And therefore, it's through the ingenious activities by these people that Egypt was capable of constructing this dam in the Fayum more than 800 years after it began.
Before the development of agriculture, I guess more than around 10,000 years ago, how did hunter-gatherer cultures respond to changes in climate as they happened?
Well, I think this is one of the most interesting topics of our prehistory as human beings. You know, the story begins with the appearance of our species and then spreading in the rest of the world from Africa and so on. But the exciting period was the period between 22,000 years ago and 10,000 years ago, because that was the prelude to food production. Food production, of course, was the greatest event in the history of humankind. It has transformed us totally, you know, from the world of the foragers, the hunters and the gatherers and the fishermen, to people who are living in villages and later in towns, people who are in political, you know, enjoying political systems, large organizations, division of labor. All kinds of things emanated out of that period. So the people before the rise of food production, during this critical period between 22,000 and 10,000 years ago, were living in very small communities. They were mobile all the time. They could not depend on any source of food that was permanent. Mm-hmm. So they would have to move with the season to find, you know, when the crops are ripe or when the fruits are ripe, when the turtles are available, when the fish are there. And so they lived with the seasons. And they also were hunting big game when it was available. They were catching birds, etc. So when the climate began to change, and that was in the period of the last glacial maximum, and then going out of that to the warming period, which began 17,000 years ago.
Got warmer and wetter. Is that right?
Yes, it got warmer and wetter. And what was... But But during the cold period, during this period of 22,000 to 17,000, cold and dry, the people have a lot of problems eating a living because, you know, the big game was disappearing, seasons were changing, the availability of food. So they went into what I call low-order food. It's the food that you normally would not eat, even if you know it's available. I mean, maybe potatoes, maybe something that you don't particularly like. And at that time, the cereals that we now consume in large quantities in different forms, in biscuits and cakes and bread and so forth, the grains were very, very small, and it's almost like wild grass.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, it was famine food. You can only eat it when you are really about to starve. And so they began to eat these low-order foods. In some areas, they ate snails, you know, which later became, of course, something desirable in France. In other places, they began to try to catch rabbits and birds that are difficult to catch. And they did that with inventing the bow and arrow. They realized also that they would need to preserve food if they have it for a time when they don't. So they began to preserve. They decided that maybe we can get all these acorns and pistachios, whatever, and began to collect them. But then they have to grind them to make them edible. So they had grinding stones. And they did the same thing with rhizomes and other edible plants that take a long time to process. So the low-order food, something that you may not like because of its taste, something because you don't feel good when you eat it, you may have constipation or diarrhea or something else, or stomach ache, something that would take a very long time to collect when otherwise there is something else available, so why spend, go through the trouble of getting it. Or it take a very long time to process, like you have to grind it, you have to soak it in water, you have to do that. So you forgo these things in normal years. But when there is not enough food, then you are forced to go to these foods. Now, what happens is that some of those foods, and this is, I think, the leap to the next part of the story, is that some of those foods lend themselves to become domesticable, to be able to respond to human efforts to manage, and in particular, there was the story of the barley and wheat. That's the most successful story in these different things that they try to eat. Only the wheat and barley became very successful domesticable plants.
Let me jump in here for just a second. Something I've always wondered about is, were the first efforts to grow things like barley and wheat, do you think they were an accident? Like people were taking these low-order foods and maybe they were grinding them all in one place and then they came back a few months later and realized that 10 more plants had grown up where some seeds had fallen before? Or is the understanding among experts that somebody thought, hey, let's try and plant these and put more in this location?
Well, you know, even if it's an accident, accidents do not lead to change unless you become conscious of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always the human consciousness of what's happening around you. And I think that's the key. But I think they did manage, and we do have evidence now, that they transplanted things, that they interfered with weeding, they interfered with maybe watering something, they interfered with keeping birds and rats away and stuff. So that was the initial stage. I mean, it's not that they all of a sudden discovered that, you know, hey, things grow when they fall on the ground. I think they knew that all along.
Mm-hmm.
So that was almost a constant. But the point was, and I think that's the interesting thing about the wheat and barley, as I was mentioning, is that first, it exists in very large quantities. If you now want to go to cereal grain, yes, you have huge fields of wild grass. So you can collect as much as you can. And that was one reason to get more people together at the time, because it also matures at a certain time and then the seeds would fall. So as soon as they are ripe, you know, you have to have a very large group of people and go collect as much as you can. So it's huge. It can allow people. So, okay, once you collected it, then you need to process it and you can keep it for times in famine. You know, because you can store it even for 2 years to come. So it becomes insurance food, which is really have a premium. And at that time, they we begin to see storage facilities. We begin to see the grinding stones. We begin to see the use of sickles for harvesting. We begin to see large communities. We begin to see evidence of social cohesion, because in order to keep a group together, then you need some rituals, you get some burial rites. So we see the beginnings of that. And that happens even before full domestication, because they start managing it before they become really fully committed to that. Because the conservative aspect in us says that, well, I cannot abandon what I'm doing until I'm sure of something else. Right. You know, if I have a job, I'm not going to jump and leave it to something else, which is a little bit risky. So throughout, and so the process of change took millennia, literally, you know, from they began experimenting probably 14,500 years ago. It's only at 10,000, about 4,000 later, than we see the domestics. But for 1,500 years before the rise of domestication, we see the good evidence that they were cultivating wild cereals and cultivating wild pulses. Now, one of the very interesting things that we should be concerned with is the impact of food on the diet and nutrition, something, of course, we're very conscious of nowadays because of the impact that we know of diet on diseases. But if you just eat cereals, you will suffer some problems because they do not have some of the essential amino acids that you get in good protein, high-quality protein, like beans and lentils and chickpeas, and which you also get in some of the nuts. So what happened is that the decision, and this has to be a decision, the decision to begin to farm is to farm a combination that is dietary balanced. So the first evidence of domestication, we see the combination of the lentils and the peas and the chickpeas together with the wheat and the barley. And at the same time, they also add a few sheep and goats so that they can guarantee to have a little bit of milk. And so this was the major of this package is what transformed the world.
My guest is Dr. Fekri Hassan. His talk this weekend at SMU is called Living on the Edge, Origins and Spread of Food Production in the Near East and North Africa. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Fekri Hassan. He is Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at University College London. He's in town to give the Fred Wendorf Distinguished Lecture in Archaeology at SMU this Saturday evening at 5:30. The title is Living on the Edge, Origins and the Spread of Food Production in the Near East and North Africa. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So it's one thing to develop an agrarian society, and then it's another thing to, I suppose, evolve over time a hierarchical way of putting people in charge. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, that's one of the major transformations in human societies, and how you go from first the bands that people lived in under foraging conditions, because when the people were living on hunting and gathering and collecting plants and fishing, the numbers of the groups were quite small. The numbers were small, and the size of the group was small, and the population density was very low. So you didn't need any complex social organization. In fact, if there was a very complex organization, it would have been hazardous for them, because it meant that they cannot split when there is not enough food. So they had to be flexible. When they began to farm, it became important to have large groups to cultivate the fields and to work on processing. And a division of labor would have existed between different people. Some people are herding animals and some people are cultivating and so on. So this is a crucial issue. Were they bonded together by some peaceful ways, or was there somebody that coerced them to stay and not to leave? And this has been debated for a long time. But my own work shows that what happened is that you started with cooperative groups, small villages working together. Why would they do that? Because agricultural yield is not stable from one to the next, not just because of climate change. Even under the same climate, as you know, the farm yield depends on all kinds of variables that you cannot control. So in one year, this village may not have enough food while the other village will have a lot of food, and vice versa. So it would only make sense for these villages to say, okay, let us help each other. You know, when I have more food, I can give it to you. And when the reverse happens, then we can deal with this issue. So I think this was the beginning of nucleating these small groups into larger regional groups. And of course, that could not be done without having fun, without having feasts, and without having parties. And luckily, with the grain, then they can have beer. And so civilization comes with a lot of enjoyable things for these local communities that make them bond. Like you still do it in the church on Sunday when people congregate. That's another way. And in fact, that was the emergence of religions in this way, congregational religions, in which people then would have something in common. They had some common belief. They also would intermarry, and a lot of these villages would have kinship ties. And because of the success of this process, then other provinces would start working together because, as you know, in banking, the more people that collaborate, the better it is for each individual.
It's like risk management.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So by expanding the size of the group, everybody is buffered against mm-hmm. any problems. But there is a point by which it reaches a certain point in size. You cannot depend on kinship ties because the other group is not related to you by kinship. So you have to use some other artificial ways by which you can bring these groups together. And so you nominate somebody, you nominate a council of elders, you nominate somebody who is distinguished by his or her wisdom. And as a result of that, you begin to create a system that uses people that are not related to any particular community that is distant from them. And at that point, then that person, who becomes more or less a foreigner for other people in the villages, have to display his status. And that's when they begin to have feathers and they begin to have gold amulets and jewelry and things that they can have that nobody else can have. So you show your status through acquiring luxury goods that other people cannot afford. And that goes even to the pyramids, you know, how many people can build a pyramid. But that particular chief, by being able, of course, to receive gifts from the people that he is serving, ends up becoming a pharaoh or a king that has a lot of resources and have the ability, in fact, to use force against people who become delinquent, say, in participating in the community.
It seems to be an almost universal human impulse to have feelings of some kind of spirituality. But I wonder about, was it necessary to have people living in these groups in order to have the emergence of any kind of codified religious belief?
We don't have any evidence of codified religious beliefs. Well, because code is a very charged word. And it comes with systematic religions, when we have the books, when we have the laws, when we have that. But of course, there was always spirituality. I mean, it's part of the makeup of a human being, because we have what I call the transcendental mind. It's a mind that does not live in the present as much as it does live in the future, in the past. And this transcendence means that our mind has a major component that is not related to reality. It's related to the world of unreality. And it can think of things that have no parallel in the world. It can think of absolutes, like absolute power or absolute knowledge. things that we are incapable of, but we are capable through our mind to think of entities that have that. And of course, if you are in a time of want, if you see somebody who is sick and you cannot help them, you seek a higher power to help you. And that higher power would be part of what you think of. And of course, through dreams, we do see departed individuals. So we begin to think of the spirits. And we think of there is another world that's not like ours. And that becomes an emotional, a chargeable thing because it has an impact on us because we are emotional beings. We are not just rational creatures, contrary to what some economists think. People are very emotional. And I think many of our so-called rational decisions or even debates are stem out from an emotional perspective and trying to defend a certain point.
So, Fakhri, how can we apply the kinds of things that you study about response to climate change in the ancient world to the problems we're facing now, given that the conditions that may happen physiologically or geologically, excuse me, on the planet may resemble what we've seen in the past, but our technology is different, our understanding of the processes of these things is different. We would seem better positioned, and yet it seems that we're having a hard time taking any action to prepare for these things.
Well, we are better positioned by far because we have a deeper memory. You know, these people had no way of going back thousands of years to see what climate is doing. And now I'm telling you stories about climate that 20,000 years ago, what was going on, and 14,000. These people had no knowledge beyond the decades. The living memory was probably 100 years, so they wouldn't remember what's happening. So they can't be surprised. We have no reason to be surprised. But it took us a very long time to try to believe that climate change is happening and that it happens all the time. You know, it's laughable when we see somebody, well, let's stop climate change. It was all over there. Now, the problem that I see is that there are ways by which we can make the change, but the existing system, by its conservative approach, does not want to go into that. And I mean, the people that have vested interest in maintaining the system are not interested in this. And part of it, I think, is the division that we have created of nation states. You know, remember that we have the beginning of a state society by people collaborating together. But we ended up now with these huge entities that are politically separate and, sadly enough, at sometimes antagonistic. So we do not see that we have a common problem when we are facing climate change. And we have a greater problem than the people had in the past, because if anything happens to one country, it would affect another. And in fact, as we know that from pollution, industrial pollution, it spreads and contributes to climate change. So the fact that we are not willing together as nations to come back with a common policy is one of our failures. But that's because we have this inherited idea of this nation against the other nation, where we have to go into a world of nations as these little groups at the beginning of time created the state. We need now to have a world management between the nation states. That does not mean that they would not have any sovereignty or anything like that, because you can still have, like in the States, you have United States and you have states. And so I think some kind of this order will appear inevitably in the world. At the same time, we have a worse problem, because the change that we are creating, like population increase or the waste as a result of high rates of consumption, is leading to a very, very fast rate of impact. So here, while these people had very little impact on the environment, we are having a tremendous impact on the environment in an extremely accelerated way, meaning that we do not have much time to think and act if there is something that grave and something that can have serious consequences on transportation system, on food production, and on conflict between countries. So I think the wise policy in this is to not to have waited to believe that there is 100% good evidence for a climatic event, but in fact to work with the wise decision-making principle that if the outcome is going to be too risky, too dangerous, then I will act even if the probability is not very high. You know, it's like taking medicine for heart attack to avoid a heart attack. You know, even though the probability may not be very high, but there is some probability, so people take that medicine. I think in that case, this applies to us as well.
Is there historical precedent for that? Have we done this successfully in the past?
Have we
worked together, sort of recognizing that a problem is imminent that will affect societies beyond our own?
Yes, I think we have a presence of that with after First World War and Second World War, when nations that were at war realized that this cannot be sustained. So we have the United Nations and we have the UNESCO. And I think these are some of the very positive developments as a result of the slaughter that happened among European countries. And it happened, as you know, a lot of intellectuals were against this mass slaughter and killing and the problem that happened. And we have moved into a more cooperative venture. But still, some nation states are reticent of recognizing that really there is a world order. And it had to be based on cooperation and equity and recognition and respect for the others. So as I mentioned to you, change usually takes a very long time. In the past, it took millennia. And then in these recent cases, maybe hundreds of years, but I think we don't have that luxury. We are only have a few decades to be able to overcome our problems.
Fekri Hassan is Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at University College London, in town to give the Wendorf Distinguished Lecture in Archaeology at SMU Saturday at 5:30. The talk is called Living on the Edge, Origins and Spread of Food Production in the Near East and North Africa. Fekri, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you. My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.